Tap into the passion and vision of well-known entertainment luminaries with Thinking Out Loud. Go on a journey with unfiltered access to today's media innovators. Hear their strategy for rising above the crowded landscape. Important lessons and valuable wisdom that only comes from real industry experience.
Hello, I'm Vicki Lins, President and CEO of CTAM, a marketing organization focused on the media entertainment technology industry. Welcome to a special episode of Thinking Out Loud. Recently, CTAM hosted our executive education program at Harvard Business School. The week-long program is developed to challenge minds and invigorate the careers of experienced media, entertainment, and technology executives. It's an awesome week. This year, I had the opportunity to interview Tom Rutledge, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Charter Communications, as our guest speaker. It was a privilege to tap into Tom's 45 plus years of industry knowledge and experience, and I thought it was a great opportunity to turn it into an episode of Thinking Out Loud for our curious knowledge-seeking audience. I hope you enjoy it. I'm Vicki Lins. I'm the President and CEO of CTAM. For those of you I don't know, obviously you're having a fabulous week. I don't have to ask because I know. And it keeps getting better and better, and that's what's going to happen with this session because we are really fortunate to have Tom Rutledge with us today, the President and CEO of Charter Communications. I'm not going to go through Tom's bio because he's got 45 plus years of leadership experience in the industry, and we'd rather tap into that knowledge and experience than go through the checklist of positions held. So with that, let's get started. Tom, I want to start at the very beginning.
Okay.
Because you literally climbed your way up in this industry.
Yes.
In 1972, when you were in college, you were a technician climbing poles.
That's right.
So how does that experience inform your leadership style today and the way you view leadership?
Actually, quite a lot. I started in 1972. My first job title was grunt, which I thought was the sound I was making as I was throwing the taps up to the linemen to install in the network, but it was actually German for ground. That was an actual title. So I had it. So I literally had the lowest title you can have. I was there sort of accidentally because of a family tragedy, actually, and I went to work, and I really liked it, and it was a great experience. And then I did start going to school. So I went to cable before I went to school. Actually started at night school, and then I quit working and eventually got a degree in economics. But, you know, I've always felt about leadership that the key to leadership is knowing what you're talking about. A lot of people think about other things when they think about leadership. They think about style and how to get people's attention, how to emote. My view is that if you understand how things work and what you're trying to accomplish, and know it at a detail level, people can tell what you're talking about. And if people know what you're talking about, they want you to lead them. Because if you have a vision of how everything fits together, and it's an accurate vision, people get that. And they understand that, feel that, and then they treat you well. And if people treat you well, you tend to project better. So my view is the core to leadership is knowing what you're talking about.
When you and I talked in preparation for today, you said you spend a lot of time talking to the Charter employees and sharing your vision, sharing your ideas with your own employees. How important is that communication to driving the trust, the alignment, and the effectiveness of the organization?
Well, again, I think it's about a coherent explanation of what you're trying to do as a company when you're in my position, or, you know, depending on where you sit and what your objective is from a leadership perspective. But you need to have a coherent, integrated view of what it is that you're trying to do, how you're going to do it, why if you do it this way, it'll work, and why you'll get the results you'll get, and how the various activities that you're trying to get people to do and live, how they interrelate in a way that's going to generate success. And so the job of the communication is to pull the vision of all the detail together in a way that people can understand and articulate how the business or how the entity is supposed to function. and why you're doing it that way and why you're going to win in the marketplace if you do it that way.
So let's talk a little bit about the why. How much has the why evolved over the years to driving the value for customers and the impact of the business?
Well, I can make a macro statement. The cable business was initially an entrepreneurial business. When I joined it, there were lots of individual owners. Because it's so capital intensive, it doesn't produce earnings and it doesn't produce cash when the initial investments are made. And, you know, when you do that in a public company environment, that's hard to do. So the company I grew up in, Time Inc., they wanted to be in cable, but for on and off, they always had these crises of, well, it's not making any money and we're spending lots of capital. We have all these great magazines. All of our assets at Time Inc. go home at night. And you've got all this stuff. They used to call ATC all that capital. So you have a business that doesn't lend itself to quarterly earnings when it's being developed. So that's why the industry is still owned the way it is. I mean, if you think about all the family controlled businesses that are in our industry, Time Inc. was kind of the one that wasn't. But all the rest are, at some level, have a family behind them. Because of the boom bust and the not so much boom bust, but you know, long economic cycles interspersed with macroeconomic cycles of capital investment. So you have to have a lot of guts to stick with it. It's hard to do that in a public company. And so that said, the industry also has attracted from time to time, and it does, and it has it right now, you know, fly by night, sort of, not fly by night, but people who are strictly financial operators and looking for really a financial play as opposed to a building a network and building long-term customer relationships. In many cases, you know, as people buy assets and lever them and then sell them again, you know, as a levered buyout kind of thing or a private equity kind of thing. That's been in and out of our business. So the why for me has always been, in terms of what I've been trying to do as someone who's created value in these assets, is to try to penetrate the marketplace as far as I can, to get all the effects, the network of, we were talking a lot about network effects, to get the effects of market share driven penetration on a fixed infrastructure. And to get that, you have to have a really good service relationship. You have to penetrate. You have to have as many customers as you can. And the beauty of our business is, if you do it right, in my view, is that you have a fixed infrastructure. So Charter today is 800,000 miles of infrastructure, 54 million homes passed and businesses passed with that, and 32, 33 million customer relationships, which means that there's, you know, 20 million dwellings or businesses that we pass with a completely paid for infrastructure that don't have a relationship with us. Well, every customer we get out of that remaining universe costs less than the ones we already have. So it's a very virtuous situation the deeper you penetrate. So we have a market share strategy. The deeper you penetrate, the less it costs. Your fixed costs get distributed over a bigger and bigger number, which means on an average basis, they all go down. The costs go down per customer, which means from a competitive point of view, if you can grab market share, it makes everyone who competes against you have a more expensive environment than you are in, which means that you can have better products at lower prices and still be profitable if you have a customer-focused, market share-driven strategy. So that's the core of
there's a lot.
Think about the why and how you get there's a lot of doing in there.
There's a lot packed into that, but when you break it down that way, you make it sound almost easy, and it is anything but. It's a very complex industry with a lot of different moving pieces. You and I talked a little bit about the Charter playbook. Most people in this room have probably heard the term. Somebody will say, oh, that's a page right out of the Charter playbook. And when I first mentioned that to you, you said, I'd love to know what's in the Charter playbook. So I'm going to, as far as you're concerned, but I'm going to ask you, like, what is that Charter playbook and what role does it play in executing on what you just laid out for us as that market share strategy?
The way I think that originates is, you know, Charter did this complex transaction, a series of them in 2016, where we merged with Time Warner and with Bright House and with Optimum West or Resonant Communications. So you had four companies coming together. Lots of complexity and legacy in all of those businesses. The original business was set up at the first cable systems I worked in as a manager trainee I had 8,000 customers. First one I worked in as a tech had 3,000, but the big system, my second big system was 11,000 customers. So, you know, through my experience, the industry got decentralized, was systems based on more rural reception-based markets than it became after satellite technology came along and we could do HBO and all of that and wire the urban markets, but it was managed locally. So even those individual assets that came, Time Warner, Bright House, Optum West, they had legacies inside of them that were quite distinct because they were managed at a DMA level, a marketplace level, and then put together when we, in the 90s, when we put the fiber backbone into the networks and made it a two-way interactive market that was designed to sell interactive TV, not broadband. There was no notion of broadband. So my view is broadband and interactive TV have finally become what it was supposed to be. But when Charter did these acquisitions, it had a lot of legacy and for a lot of reasons. And Charter was the smallest piece of, or about this much. We were about 25% of all of that. So our view is they are complex businesses and they have lots of moving parts. They have lots of different technology infrastructure components that are different. And different video platforms, different billing platforms, different broadband CMTS infrastructure platforms, the routing of the broadband network infrastructure, different telephony switching systems. So if we wanted to bring this together, we needed to do it one way. We needed to do it quickly and to begin to take advantage of our scale and our ability to get all those effects of having a more highly penetrated business. So we had to be able to sell, market, stand up good common products, uniform prices everywhere. You know, good. There's three legs of our strategy. One is the products and prices, and we want to bring all our products together and make them together as a package work better economically than any of them independently operate. So better video, but also better video pricing, better broadband, better phone. And that when we did the deal and now better mobile, when you have all of that connectivity in one package, it interrelates and it's a better package than you can individually buy the component pieces for. Second strategy we wanted to have was to treat service as a product. It's a big 800,000 mile, really capital intensive infrastructure. From a customer experience, it's a service business. So we want to make our transactions as customer friendly and as efficient with the least amount of friction possible. And there's friction in our business because we have to go to houses. We have to crawl through attics. And we have to make appointments and we have to meet them and we have to move through traffic. And it's not an easy business to manage from a service perspective. So we want service as a product. And that actually, service as a product, covers a lot of sins. One of the interesting things, I'll digress, is Bresnan Communications didn't have very good infrastructure, but it had really great service and it had really great penetration. So it wasn't the technology so much, it wasn't the pricing so much, it was the service that made it a sticky environment. And last, you want to have a relationship with the community, the third leg of the stool that keeps you from tipping over. Which is, you know, we're a business that deals in a complex regulatory environment. We have legacy cable television regulation. We have phone regulation. We have wireless regulation. We have privacy regulation. We have, and people care about what we do and feel like they have a role to play with the way we operate as a business. So we have to navigate that through different climates and different times. And so having a connection to the community through both good service operations, but also having your employees reflect the communities you serve and having, like we do, a local news channel in most of the markets we operate, which in many ways is our face, but it's also our involvement with the community. And those, all of that together creates the opportunity to build this value. And so when we put all the companies together, we had to decide how we were going to do that and which legacy we were going to reflect. And so we said, look, we know what we're doing at Charter works. We know that if we operate this way, kind of the way I just described it at a detail level, will be successful. It may not be the smartest and best way in the world to operate, but it'll work. And we've just spent $90 billion and we need to make this work. And so we're not going to sit around analyzing everything there is to analyze about the future of customer service or the future of infrastructure. We're just going to do it our way. We know it may not be the way you would do it, but we have to pick one. And we're going to do this right now, and then we'll figure out, after we get it integrated and organized, we'll figure out what the best is. So we didn't want the best to drive out the good. And the good was what we knew. We knew we could be successful if we did what we knew how to do. And so that's what I think the charter playbook is when it's reflected from the person who's being said, no, we're going to do it this way. But it wasn't that we were so arrogant to think that that was the only way.
And it did work. And you were able to operationalize incredibly efficiently and very quickly. I don't want to neglect talking about the role of culture and the employees, especially since right before lunch, this class was looking at an organizational behavior case study and was talking about the role of culture and trust and compassion and leadership and environments. You've got different companies coming together with disparate cultures, with different strategies and operating principles. What did the leadership look like to get everyone aligned on the human level to pull this off?
Well, there's a lot of culture in every company, even at a lot of sub-levels too. We have a lot of operations in El Paso. It's different than Maine. And it feels different than Maine. And the way people interact with each other feels different than Maine. So there's culture that's why I'm saying we have to be connected to the community. And, I started out in franchising. So I built cable systems in the day, and at night I would go to city council meetings and try to get more franchises. I had a big VCR walking around called the Wired Nation and my tape and, present this vision to communities. But Charter has 8,000 franchises and local franchise relationships. So there's more to culture than just the corporate culture. There's the culture where people live inside your company. So our view, we're not trying to create a particular culture. We're trying to be best. We try to articulate from a leadership perspective what we're trying to accomplish and what we're trying to do. We try to let anybody who can do that do it. So we want to be open-minded to culture and not let anybody's background interfere with their opportunity inside the company, because we can't see them for who they are. But so it's a work first culture. I'm always telling our PR people, remember, it's all about the work. That's why we're here. We're here to do this work. And we're trying to figure out how to work together to accomplish the objectives of the business. All the culture fits around that. And the desire of us from a cultural perspective is to allow whatever culture exists to exist and not let that interfere with the work. So it's a work first culture is the way I think of it.
I'm going to shift gears towards content distribution right now. Let's start a little general, and then I'll ask you about the Charter Comcast announcement, because I'm sure everybody would be interested to hear your thoughts on that particular joint venture. But moving forward, what role do you see video content playing in Charter's product portfolio?
Well, Charter is a pure play cable company. It was good in the stock market for a while. It hasn't been today. But, we do have we have a local news channel environment. So we think localism is being destroyed from a video perspective because of the way television's owned at the local level, and other forces are driving local media into extinction in many cases, newspapers. We've tried to fill that void with our local news business, and I think we've done that successfully. So that's just a small piece. The big piece of our video business, our historic video business, is that it is very high priced and it's priced a lot of people out of the market. The cost of a fully loaded expanded basic cable product today is, to have any kind of margin at all, you got to be close to $100 of revenue. And so it's become very difficult. It's priced a lot of people out of the market. And there have been alternative opportunities, particularly non-sports programming. And so you've got this continuous erosion of that big fat bundle. Got media companies that really still the vast majority of their revenues are driven by the two-tier revenue stream from license fees and advertising. And you have direct-to-consumer models that are also much more difficult to manage than meets the eye. So it's a difficult environment for us to operate in. We have to pass things through. Prices go up. Revenues don't go up because customers fall off as fast as the prices go up. And yet everybody who's in that ecosystem can't get a better model than what they had yet. And so it's very difficult. So we continue plugging away. You know, on the margins, we've been pretty successful on a relative basis. You know, we've created some low price package tiers, but a lot of the bundling and the contracts that we have with the programmers that we deal with, we spend about $12 billion a year on content. You know, they all want to be carrying the same package. And the reason they want to be carrying the package is they want the distribution and they want the pull through of all the other programming in the package. In an all a la carte world, you end up with a smaller business and a more highly priced business. And so it's challenging for everybody in it. And we're on the margins trying to be good at it. And we want to be the best video provider we can be because we think it's part of the relationship. And it is still the most powerful medium there is. Mm. And I'd love to be better at selling it. And I'd love to have more packages. And I think if I did, I could create aggregated packaging that would resonate in the marketplace and I'd create more customers. But I don't know how we get from here to there.
Folks here may not know that you and your team created the original triple play at Cablevision way back when. And that, you know, historically it was the most successful marketing package really ever.
We're still on that playbook. I guess that's the Charter playbook.
And that, of course, was TV, phone, and internet. So what does the evolution of that look like moving forward?
The key to the triple play, if you think about it, and when we launched the triple play, it doesn't matter what you call it. I mean, it's nice to have good brands and nice to articulate them in the marketplace. But what mattered there was that you were taking a phone business that had an average rate. This is wireline phone, POTS, plain old telephone service. Average bill in the New York metropolitan area where we launched this was about $78, I believe, for monthly phone service, including fees. And we launched it for $29.99. And so that $50 is what was there. People got a $50 reduction in their communications cost. And they had a package of products that were just as good. It cost $50 less. That's the glory of the triple play. And the mobile industry creates the same opportunity. The average mobile customer household spends about $132 a month. The average broadband customer with promotions and everything, if you look at the ARPU revenue per unit out there, is about $60 a month. So there's a lot more money being spent on mobile per household than there is on broadband. So if we cut the mobile business pricing in half, and we can make money doing that, and everybody takes mobile from us. You know, Charter and Comcast are the two biggest wireline phone companies in America today. And everyone thought what we were doing on the pricing from a wireline phone business was crazy. But think about it from a mobile perspective. It's a similar opportunity if you cut that $132 or $130 a month in half to $65 a month. Our $60 of revenue per customer would still go up 100% to $125, and the mobile business would go down in half. So that's the opportunity today with mobile.
So I'm going to ask you a mobile question, and then I do want to come back to the Charter Comcast deal. Is mobile another product to be bundled to provide connectivity value to customers, or is it really more strategic than that? Are we bridging the wired and wireless worlds and taking the customers on a different journey into that space?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of ways to talk about it provocatively. I was just talking about it simply there. Mm-hmm. It's all about the money. You know, for the family, you know, for the consumer, we can save the consumer a lot of money. We can give them more for less. That's good. That's good business. And because of what I was saying earlier, the more for less that we sell, the less it costs us to sell it. because of our network effect penetration. So it's a virtuous cycle if you can get it going, one that I think we can get going and why we're going to create so much value.
So let's go back to the recent Charter Comcast announcement.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Focused more on the video.
Oh, you were asking
business.
That, yeah.
And what is it you're hoping to accomplish with that business?
Yeah, before I go there, I was just going to, about being provocative. You know, I remember Ivan Seidenberg, who ran Verizon, you know, he said, you guys are crazy. You don't know what you're doing pricing wireline at $29.99 because that'll destroy the phone business. And I said, we're not in the phone business. And we're not in the mobile business either. So it's just another screen and it's connected. And we can make it interoperate better with our broadband network than it can operate by itself.
So do you define it as a connectivity business?
Yeah, it is a connectivity business. And we've always been a connectivity business. We just sold the connection to the antenna originally for television or the connection to the satellite.
So what connections is the Charter Comcast deal going to deliver?
Yeah, that's an interesting, that deal, the joint venture, is designed to stand up a brand new video platform. A platform is different than a network, but it's, you know, iOS, Apple is a platform. Android is a platform. Roku is a platform. There aren't many platforms. And so the Comcast joint venture is to create a scale platform for IP television. It's really designed to put app based programming first and to become a consumer device, an embedded device in apps, in TVs, smart TVs, a device platform to be sold at retail. And so it's really about taking a software platform and making it a common standard on which we can then create advertising businesses in the app based environment based on our ability to do distribution. And based on our ability to create transactions for direct-to-consumer products. So if you're a programmer and you're selling a direct-to-consumer product, if you have a distributor who can help you sell that and by their relationship with consumers give you more customers than you'd get otherwise, then you can have a symbiotic relationship with that distributor, us, this platform, to create more customers for your programming service. And so there's a dual revenue stream opportunity there, both in advertising and direct-to-consumer transaction management. But it also means that all television connections in the future will be wireless. So we're really, you know, we're a wireless business. It's just that our wire is very close to the house, to the radio that we deploy in the house.
That's actually a very interesting statement. We're a wireless business.
Yeah. Yeah, cable is a wireless business.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is true. We have 450 million devices connected to our network today. Around 40 million of them are still set-top boxes, you know, wireline set-top boxes. Actually, a little less, probably about 10 million less now. So 30 million of that 450 million are still connected by wire. But in the future, in the house and pretty much everywhere else, everything will be connected wirelessly.
There's a lot of conversation, obviously also a lot of focus on streaming these days, on consumer preferences for streaming, on the streaming wars, on ad-supported streaming services, and this platform that you were just describing is entering that space. Oh, and then of course the news about Netflix and having a bad quarterly earnings report and the ripple effect of that has been significant, with analysts now starting to question the business model, you know, the streaming model. What are your thoughts about what's going on in the streaming space, where the opportunities really lie, and the role that Charter might play in that space?
I mean, they're similar to what I was just saying. You know, it's interesting. I remember sitting with Reed Hastings at Netflix, and I've been on and off with him on a variety of things.
He has a playbook, by the way. It's written out.
Yeah. You know, and I've wanted to do deals with them on and off too through the years. And he's wanted to interfere with our transactions as well. But I remember talking to him one time about our converters, and I wanted to put Netflix on our set-top boxes and integrate it. And, you know, he had his own views about the way things ought to be all Netflix. And so we didn't get where we wanted to go. But I remember talking about our converters, and I was just doing cable math and my talking to them and say, we have 40 million converters at $8 a month and $96 a year. That's more money than Netflix brings in. And it struck me, and his company was worth more than ours. So, you know, you've had a big valuation. A relatively small component of our revenue stream was bigger than his, and yet his market cap was huge. So there's that.
There's that.
So
my revenue's bigger than yours.
No, but eventually you have to, something has to happen.
Right.
You know, you have to keep growing, and ultimately, and it's been true. Like Google and Facebook had moments where they weren't very big, but people could see how massive they would be, and they were valued for that future value. But then the question is, was Netflix properly valued? Can you get enough margin incrementally in that kind of a business? And maybe the answer is no. It's not a bad business, it's good business, but is it properly valued?
A number of very smart analysts in our industry have consistently been beating a drum about not being so fast to undermine the equity of the traditional model while this whole streaming evolution was taking place.
Right.
They're looking especially smart right now. Do you see a pivot point for the industry? Is there an opportunity where we might take a breath and revisit what we had previously built before just diving into the what's next space?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think the cat's out of the bag. The problem is that from a programmer's perspective, the old model was perfect and it reached its zenith. 100 million homes had multi-channel video, 100 million homes had license fees, all the content was in a big fat package and it was distributed to 100 million homes. So the advertising model worked. Discovery of what your content was visible in that package to everyone. But it got really expensive. And it got so expensive, it started to price people out of the market. And there are some holes in the market. There's lack of security. The lack of security and password sharing and selling content to Netflix by people who were in that traditional ecosystem that was secure let their content out for low value, and it came back into the system at a cheaper cost than the content that was in the old system was. And so then a lack of security around password sharing and other things like that allowed content to be widely distributed for free. The whole retransmission consent regime is really interesting when you think about broadcasting. Just think about security when you think, I have a great show and I'm going to blast it into the air unencrypted. That's what broadcasting is.
That's what.
Right? So you had content for free in the air, digitally available. You had content cheaply sold to new direct-to-consumer models, including Netflix. You had unsecure product digitally all over the place mm-hmm. that was available for free. And he had a high-priced package. And then what was the programmers pushed that pedal as far as they could, which, you know, is sort of normal behavior. And so you end up with a really expensive package that isn't worth what it's being sold for when you consider the alternatives are free or cheap and it shrinks. That pulls more revenue out of the ecosystem that is on the margins being created by these new things. And here we are.
Here we are. So I'm going to shift gears. One more question for me, and then I'll open it up to the class. I want to go to the connectivity bandwidth space, you know, with the rapid increased demand for bandwidth, both upstream and downstream. How well is cable positioned to upgrade its existing network to meet that demand?
I think pretty well. I think we have another real interesting cost advantage relative to competitors in terms of the upgradable nature of our network and the relatively small capital dollars that we spend. We spend $8 billion a year on infrastructure. So when I say small, they're still big dollars. But if you think about what it costs to build a brand new network through rights of way and across 54 million homes, yards, and how long that takes, it takes a long time and it's very expensive. And we have the ability to continuously upgrade our network and get more capacity out of it. You know, we just did a DOCSIS 3.1 rollout over the last several years. And we spent about $9 per home passed, or about $450 million. And we, you know, got the gig speeds everywhere we operate. There's another whole set of opportunities within that technology platform that's been deployed to get to multi-gig symmetrical out of that deployment. And then we have another pathway through what we call 10G, which is our industry standard for new technology development to get us to a 10 gig symmetrical environment. When you think about that kind of capacity, DOCSIS 4.0, which has already been proved out in lab environments, is probably ready next year for physical deployment in operating systems. We can get a lot out of our network by just deploying more capital, but relatively small dollars compared to what it would cost to replicate that network. So if we can, you know, keep our penetrations deep by having good quality services and drive deep into the market, have lower costs on average than any new entrant would have, and if we can continuously upgrade our capacity at lower costs, dollar costs, than other competitors. Now, there are wireless competitors too, and this is not a cakewalk, but we have an infrastructure that lends itself to relatively inexpensive upgrades, which means we have a better cost structure ultimately, I think, for the capacity we can deliver long run than alternatives. And so that's why I keep working in cable.
Earlier, you said if you want to lead, you have to connect. And we really appreciate your leadership in the industry, but you taking the time to connect with everybody here today. So thank you for joining us.
Hope you found this Thinking Out Loud conversation interesting and perhaps even thought-provoking. There are more on the way. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review.